So, beside the fact that Tobias being in the space of the temple leaves no space for worship or less space, crowded space for worship, we also have the fact that the foreign marriages brought another problem, and that is that the children of the foreign marriages were speaking the languages of their foreign parents rather than the Hebrew, which meant that they were losing the language of worship. They were not able to understand the words of God, which, of course, is the purpose of worship, to come into his presence, to hear what he has to say to us. And yet, they were raising a generation that could not hear God. They could not understand the words of the law, of the Pentateuch, of all of the book that Ezra had brought back from Babylon. So therefore, they could not worship. So when priests don't maintain a vital priesthood, and the society begins to make covenant partnerships with those who are not in the cohort, who love other gods, we lose not only the space for worship, but also the language for worship. And therefore, our worship becomes illegitimate. It's like many years ago when I was a kid, so many people went to church and listened to the worship service, the mass, in Latin. And when they took away the Latin, there were so many people who were upset about that. And you'd ask, why are you upset about them taking away Latin? Because it's so beautiful. Could you understand it? No. But it was beautiful. So you go to worship to listen to God talk to you, but you can't understand it, but you like it that way. And that's exactly what is happening in Jerusalem here with these foreign marriages. And we have to think about that for ourselves as well. Are we living lives that are so intertwined with the transactional paradigm of the world, with getting our desires, our psuche and our egos met, our fleshly desires met? Are we so entwined with that that we are losing the language of hearing God, of being able to hear God and what he says to us? So that, in fact, what happens is that God becomes a very transactional thing in our mind because that's all we know. That's what we have covenanted with, is transactional paradigms. And so we see God through that lens. They saw God through the lens of their foreign partners or parents that were taking up space, that were giving them a different language. And so they could only understand it through that, which completely skewed who God was and what he was saying to them. So that was the first problem. And the first obstacle in reestablishing a vital kingdom. So even though we have a temple rebuilt and walls and gates rebuilt, because the priests as a whole have not maintained a vital priesthood, have not maintained their standards, the place that they've built is occupied by things that don't protect the integrity of God, aren't able to be in his presence because of these things stopping the flow of God's presence and awareness of that. So we have that. Secondly, though, we have the Sabbath markets. So we have Nehemiah talking about the selling and buying of goods and wares and foods on the Sabbath. And it is not only the foreigners who are coming to Jerusalem, into the city and selling, but the Jerusalem residents themselves are selling to each other as well, and to the foreigners coming in. And so we have, what we have is buying and selling on the Sabbath being this concrete picture of what happens when the Sabbath isn't kept holy. It makes every day the same. Every day is full of transaction. So that there is no glimpse of what it might look like to live transformationally or celebratorily. There's no glimpse of anything but transaction, 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 transaction. It's the same. Every day is the same. And when every day is the same, it completely relegates the reality of eternity to a fairy tale. We never experience it. Although some people might disagree, it's almost as if you're living in San Diego, where the sky is blue and clear every day, and it becomes the same. And what happens is, that sounds nice sitting here where it's cloudy and gray and rainy on a spring day, and yet what you miss there are the variations of God's glory. When you have a sunny sky 365 days out of the year, you have no clouds, you have no variation in the light that's coming, nothing to obscure or to bring patterns or to bring out the different lights. So you have the same light all the time. Truthfully, even our bodies, we talk about this sometimes in the winter, like, oh, it's nice that the winter has come because we have to be inside. We have to snuggle down. The sameness doesn't give us a break from what is always there, and then we don't recognize the glory. As you all came in this morning, one of the first things everyone said was, oh, the pansies, the bright yellow pansies. Now, if they've been there every day, you would never have said a word, but because we haven't had them and all of a sudden they're there, there's this, oh, this awe, this surprise of joy, of goodness, which is exactly what the Sabbath is meant to help us enter into. And without the Sabbath, we think that the world is only transaction and we don't get that glimpse of glory. So we have the marrying of foreign foreigners coming in, taking up the space of worship, taking up the language, or getting rid of, obscuring the language of worship. We also have the Sabbath markets obscuring those, that one time in every week that we get to see a little bit of a glimpse of glory, a glimpse of what it means to live transformationally and without transaction. And thirdly, we have Nehemiah giving us a concrete example of a time when there is no opportunity for service. And that's in that the Levites, what's happening with the Levites? We find that they're not being supported with the tithes. Remember that the Levites did all of the work around the temple, inside and outside the temple, keeping everything in order and clean and ready, baking the breads and everything for the worship services, for the sacrificial services, which meant they didn't have any inheritance. In fact, what is the inheritance that God says is the Levites? They don't get land. What do they get? Right, God is their inheritance. And what Nehemiah has found in this 14 year span since he went back to Susa, and now he came back to Jerusalem after the building of the wall to see how things are going. And in this 13 year span, people have not been supporting the Levites. And so the Levites have had to go out and get their own land so that they can live, so that they can have food and a place to live. And what we see here is that the people aren't tending one another. The Levite service was to tend all of the things that would make the presence of God accessible to the people. They were the ones to invite to the presence of God. But when we don't share our gifts with one another, whether it's money, when we think of tithe, we often think of money, but of course it's more than that. The abilities that God's given us, our time, our talents, our spiritual gifts, all of that. When we're not sharing them with one another, then we don't have a place to share them. We eliminate the opportunity for service to one another. And then we don't use and utilize the gifts that God's given us. Deuteronomy told them way generations before that when you get into the land, make sure you understand that the gifts that you are given are there for the purpose of sharing with one another. Because you're living in cohort, right? You're there to uphold one another and tend one another. And the gifts that you're given, the money that you're given, the crops that you're given, are there to hold up one another and tend one another. And when you don't do that in one sector, it starts trickling down all over the place because you are in cohort. And so if we're not supporting the Levites, then the Levites can't support us in our worship, and things deteriorate into independent kingdoms once again. And then we begin to look at our gifts being solely for the purpose of getting us a good life, ourselves, our independent selves. And if the Levites end up owning property and leaving God as their inheritance, now who's going to hold up the model for what it looks like to come in mutual dependence upon God? So we're losing that. So tithing becomes a big deal here. Tithing and the Sabbath and the covenant marriages are all, they're all firsts. They're all, they speak to very important pieces of our lives where we need to give first to God so that we remember that these were given to us as gifts, that they do belong to Him, that everything we have belongs to Him, relationship belongs to Him, days, time belong to Him, our money and talents belong to Him. And because of that, God has said, first give me a piece of each of those so that you remember that these are gifts, that you remember that I'm giving to them to you as a grace, but that they belong to me. When we don't do that, we begin to lay a foundation that says, my first responsibility is to myself, which of course is an abandonment of that cohortative, communal, mutually dependent living in exchange for independent kingdoms. So we see that there is no space and no language for worship. There's no time for celebration of glory. There's no opportunity for service. And in that, we actually lose sight. We lose recognition of three things. With the foreign marriages, we lose the recognition of God's presence, of the glory of His presence. When we eschew covenant partnerships, when we decide to become one with transactional paradigms, whether it's in relationships of people or relationships of us with ways of living, doing things, we lose recognition of His glorious presence. When there's a cramped and narrowed space for worship, what we realize, and because we've made these covenant agreements with transactional ways, worship becomes boxed in by what the world likes and what the world tolerates. The world, what we have covenanted with, becomes the defining standard for worship. And the world will never say it's okay or a good thing to submit to someone else. The world says we don't submit, we don't humble ourselves to anyone, except in a transactional mode. In other words, we submit and humble ourselves to someone when it gets us what we want. And God therefore becomes a Santa Claus. If we see him through a transactional lens, he becomes a Santa Claus, and we begin to treat him as such. In fact, I think we do that often. We look at God, and God is someone I come to when I'm in trouble, when I need something, when I want something. Rather than, and I think this is why our worship has become a little discombobulated, thinking that our worship is us telling him stuff, when worship is us going to him, asking him what he would like to tell us. And I think this is why we've messed that up a little, is because we begin to, when we are in covenant with transactional paradigms, we begin to see God through transactional paradigms, and we begin to consider him a transactional being, a Santa Claus. I go to God for what I want and what I need, and when I need some suggestions or when I really think this would be a great thing. And rarely do I go to God and say, God, what do you want to tell me? I put myself in humble submission to hear you. So you see that our ways of enmeshing our lives in transactional ways, in saying that, you know, I must have an education, like Rebecca said, or we must get most for our dollar. When these become parts of our lives and it's hard to get rid of that, it affects what we see of God's presence and how we see God's presence. And in fact, we begin to not recognize his presence. So we lose recognition of his presence, but we also lose recognition of his provision. So when we don't celebrate Sabbath, when we don't have a day that's holy and different and a place where we can actually encounter eternity, when we don't have one of those, time then becomes cramped, and we begin to see time as a tool, something we can use for our benefit to get more, to beat the scarcity dragon. My focus becomes on my work, my plans, and I see what I have as coming from my own provision. I did that. I worked hard to get that. I provided. And of course, I don't recognize then that it was God who provided, because I've now used time every single day. I've never had a break from using time as my servant to get more and more done. Remember, the problem in living in scarcity is always the idea that, well, it's just because I'm not working hard enough or enough, long enough, so I will work more, work harder to get more. And because of that, I'm on this hamster wheel of continually working, striving to get more, to provide for myself. And of course, then I never recognize that God is providing without me running on the hamster trail. So we lose recognition of his presence. We lose recognition of his provision. And when we eschew tithing, we lose recognition of his purpose for us. We have a glorious purpose to come alongside God and work with him in restoring what he originally created, in restoring Eden. But when there's a cramped and narrowed opportunity for service, we're relegated to spectators. And that only furthers my own commitment to my own kingdom. Because when I'm not invested in kingdom growth, I don't pay attention to kingdom growth. I don't pay attention to my neighbor's growth. I'm not invested in that. But when I'm invested in you as a Levite, and you're invested in me as a Levite, when we're priests together and we're invested in one another, and I give you my strengths and you give me your strengths, I want to see you flourish. I've mentioned my cohort often, and this does happen, where somebody has a strength of making Excel spreadsheets. And someone has a strength of putting verses together in a different way. And when the person who does the Excel spreadsheets doesn't do it because the other person in the cohort isn't doing his job, so she can't do hers, it's a domino effect. And none of us can do our job as cohort members because each of our jobs aren't supported by the other. It's a mutually dependent. We hold up the tending of one another. And when we don't do that, we miss the fact that our purpose, our identity is to be living in cohortative relationship where we tend one another. So, though they have built the temple and built the walls and gates, the city is still lacking residents because the priesthood isn't being maintained, and they're allowing the place of worship to be taken up by foreign people. And when we talk about foreign people, we need to remember that it's concrete for them, but in reality, what it means is letting into the temple, letting into our bodies where God resides, letting in there any idea, any thought, any relationship where another God is being honored and worshiped. So these foreigners, remember we talked about this, they may and probably do worship God, but they are also worshiping Molech, whose greatest command is to feed your children to him. And that can't happen. That's it takes up the nourishment that God wants to give us in his own presence. So when these things happen, when there are covenant marriages outside of cohort, when there are Sabbath markets and when there's no tithing, we lose space and understanding for worship. We lose time to celebrate God's glory. We lose the opportunity for service. And we lose the recognition of his presence, of his provision, and our purpose. So, what's the antidote? What do we do here? Now that we've built the temple, the walls and the gates. Now what are we going to do with it? Well, I think we have three verses in Nehemiah that I think really just give a good summary. Nehemiah 12, 30, 43, and 44. The priests purified themselves. The joy of Jerusalem was heard from afar. Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites who served, for they performed the worship of their God and the service of purification. So the first thing that we need to understand when we build the temple and the wall and the gates, when we build God's presence in our lives, and we set up those foundational unity, fear of God, joy of the Lord, we set those up in our lives, then we as priests, as always, priests go first. We need to volunteer to live in the kingdom. The problem is they celebrated the building of these things, and then they pointed to it and said, isn't this great? This is where everybody should come. And this is what we do, right? Look at Christianity. It's great. This is what everyone should do. Look at the church. It's great. You should come there. Christianity says you live in grace and you live in joy and you live, this is what you should do. And yet we stand back and point to it rather than live there. It's not telling people this is a great place to live. It's living in that place and showing them it's a great place to live. God's kingdom is here and now. As priests, we willingly live here in a reality that others perhaps cannot see or don't think is necessary, and is certainly radically different than the many independent kingdoms of this world. We do so for the sake of others. That is who we are as image bearers. We are the ones to live in eternity. Yes, most people cannot see that the kingdom is here. But John said this, Jesus told us this, the kingdom is here right now. It's not this heaven idea. It's not this idea that someday, far away, we will get to be. I'm actually thrilled that the Christian bookstores are now pulling all of those books about heaven, those visions that people had of heaven. From the very beginning, as I read some of those, all I could think of was, this is wrong theology. This is incorrect theology. It is not what God says about heaven. They may have had these visions, and there may be some purpose to them. I'm sure there was. But the purpose wasn't to say, oh, everybody come to Christ because someday you'll get to go to heaven. When that happens, we have a problem. Because we begin to live, we just are going to live here transactionally, waiting for. And we're not going to live here in the kingdom and show people the reality of kingdom here now, eternity here now, God's glory here now, us as image bearers here now. So, as priests, we go first. We volunteer to live in the kingdom. Secondly, we also commit to keeping the priesthood vital. Vitality requires health and attention to our connection to the source. And again, we do so for the sake of others. Because without a vital priesthood, the kingdom has no one to open the doors, the gates, and invite people in. Our priesthood must remain vital. Our connection with God's presence must remain vital, which means, of course, if I'm going to be committed to keeping my priesthood vital, I'm going to have to go back and re-examine the covenant relationships and the Sabbath markets and the Levitical tithing. But my commitment is going to be that my priesthood is for others and I'm going to keep it healthy. Priests also, I love this, all of Judah rejoices over the priests and Levites who served, for they performed the worship of their God and the service of purification. Those words there, the words service of purification. Service means to guard or to protect, to preserve. And purification, the word is brightness, splendor, clearness. So the service of purification, which Israel rejoiced at the priests doing, was a service of preserving and guarding their brightness, their shininess, their glory. That's the service they were providing. They're guarding the glory of God, and the glory of God reflected in us. So as a priest, I remember that I'm preserving our shininess so that we are able to reflect better and more often the God whose presence brings us the abundance of life. So God says that our first of everything goes to Him because it belongs to Him in the first place. And in giving Him the first part, saying, my covenant relationship with you will dictate all of my relationships in my life, of all the paradigms. My Sabbath will dictate the rhythm of my time. The tithing will dictate my service to one another in our cohort. It lays a different foundation for living. Oh yeah, this is his. He's letting me use it. This is cohort. Oh yeah, it lets me recognize that. So that not only will I go first, but I will purify myself. Nehemiah calls them to purify themselves. And I do love that amongst all the priests in 11, 12, and 13, we do have other citizens coming and volunteering to live and being purified as well. So the priests that did volunteer to go in and live were models enough so that others came and do that. But the purifying that Nehemiah calls them to is a purifying, once again, because this is the base, the Shema, he calls them to purify their hearts and their minds and their strengths. So to purify the hearts, he's asking them to separate themselves from the loves of the world. The world loves whatever is satisfying to self, to my psuche, to my bios, to my physical, fleshly desires and lusts. To purify myself means to separate myself from loving that. Any paradigm that I might join myself to become one with, that would be hard to let go of. To purify our minds means that we are going to separate ourselves from the rhythms of the world. Because the rhythms of the world will always be ones that press us to strive. Work harder, work more, do more, be more busy. And to purify myself, I need to separate myself from that paradigm, that rhythm paradigm. God has a different rhythm for us. And for my strengths, I need to purify myself, separate myself from the building projects of the world. They will always encourage building their own kingdom. And I need to separate myself from thinking, from using my talents and strength to build up my reputation, to build up my possessions, to build up my good feelings, to build up whatever is mine. I separate myself from saying, that's what I'm building. I'm building something for the kingdom. It's why we put this addition on. It helps us to, literally, we made a decision to put on an addition so that we could have groups like this in here. Our build, literally and physically, our building project was so that others could come together and talk and fellowship and be about God's word, rather than putting an addition on so that we look better. We have a better house than anyone. We have a more space than anyone. We've got to separate ourselves from that. And why do we need to separate? Because that always becomes a controversial word, right? Separate. But we need to understand we separate from these things, these paradigms, these ways that the world works, because they defile our priesthood. They make our priesthood ineffective. They don't let us offer a different way of living and being human. Then we only offer what the world already offers. And when we do so, we let God reorient our hearts and mind and strength so that we can use them from a place of wholeness, rather than from the place that everyone else is using them in the world to make their own kingdoms. Now, we do have to say, there's a warning here. There are dangers to separating self. We must understand what we are separating from and what we are separating to. Because we might think that if the gates need to be closed on Sabbath, that It would be even better not to have any dealings with the world, to shut the gates permanently, letting the Jerusalem kingdom be our city only, an exclusive club of comfort. Of course, this was never the plan of Eden, nor was it the plan for Israel, who was blessed with God's blessing in order to be a blessing. If they, or we, lose this perspective, we also miss our calling as priests, bringing others in and near to God's presence. Unfortunately, Israel did just this, and so have we. We have had times that we've thought it's just much better to pull away from the world, have our own little Christian communities, so that we have our own bookstores and our own material possessions, everything Christian, so that we're pulling away from the world, separating ourselves, not from loving the ways of the world, but from the world. But God has never done this. He does not love the ways of the world, but he loves the world. He loves the people of the world. He loves the creation that he's made, which is what we're called to do. But it's very tempting when Nehemiah calls for a purification, for a separating of self, to begin to separate ourselves from the world. Israel does this. And it's at this time, particularly in their history, that Israel becomes completely nationalistic. They have a difficult time recognizing God's presence and provision and their purpose when it was revealed in Jesus because of that. And here's a really cool thing. Because Ezra and Nehemiah are so concerned about getting these people back from Babylon, reestablished in the kingdom, building the temple, building the walls and gates, and so concerned about them separating themselves from sin, separating themselves from idolatry, that they take it farther and separate themselves from the world. And because of that, God has someone write the book of Jonah during this time. Now we think about Jonah and all the things that happened in Jonah as happening way before then, which they did. They happened in the time of Jeroboam the second, I believe. But it's not written about until this time. And the reason it's written about now is because Jonah, the book of Jonah, we know, is all about seeing that the nations are to hear about the God of mercy and grace. In fact, not only does Jonah, of course, told to go to Nineveh, and he represents Israel, he doesn't, right? He runs away. But even in his running away, what happens? He goes on the boat, and here the Phoenician sailors, through all the things that Jonah does and doesn't do, they come to praise and worship Yahweh and sacrifice to Yahweh. They have their other gods. They're worshiping to them, and all of a sudden they understand that Yahweh is a God of great mercy and grace, and they bow to him. So you see Jonah as this figure of what Israel has been like. Here is what is happening with Israel in Ezra and Nehemiah, being so nationalistic that they forget who they are. They forget their mission to the world. They've run away from that, shutting themselves away. In doing so, that's not going to stop Eden from growing, because God's purposes will not be stopped. Jonah is written so that Israel doesn't miss out on the fact that they are the priests for the world. They're to share their blessing to the world, to share the God of mercy to the nations. So we have that, and we bring that here because it's the same temptation for us. To separate from the world and have our own little enclave, our own little, and yet we are called to be, we are blessed. Through Israel, we're blessed. And we better not do the same thing Israel did and miss our purpose of being a blessing to the world. So we have, to protect a vital priesthood, we need to go first. We need to purify ourselves. And thirdly, we need to enter sanctuary. When I let God reorient my heart and mind and strength, he gives me better ways to protect them. He redefines the place of my heart and my mind and my strength, giving them sanctuaries where they can thrive. Priests are invited to enter into the experiences of covenant relationships, of Sabbaths, of tithing, as experiences of eternity, where we get little glimpse of being whole image bearers. These three things are protections. Covenant marriages, covenant relationships, relationships where God is God, where God is the source of life, relationships with paradigms where God is the source of life, is a protection for our heart, because in it we get to experience vulnerable, cohortative rule. So in a real covenant marriage, right, this is what happens. We get to experience vulnerable rule, where one is not on top of the other, but that we rule together as priests, that we're vulnerable with one another. And in a covenant marriage, a covenant relationship, there's safety in that. There's protection. And I can experience vulnerable rule without being totally destroyed. Now, there's risk, of course, because we are human. We're not real good at this. But it does give us the place to practice it. We get a glimpse of what it really is like to be an image bearer who vulnerably rules. And then we come to Sabbath. And I want to spend just a few more minutes on Sabbath, more so than the covenant marriages or the tithing, because all of these are protections. But Sabbath is a protection for our mind. And perhaps we don't think about that. But Sabbath is a place that we enter, that God gives us, a place to enter and celebrate glory. It's experiencing delight of creation and recreation. There are two places that God commands Israel to celebrate the Sabbath. And in Genesis, we have him telling us, celebrate the Sabbath, because on the Sabbath, God rested from his creation. And so we have this one time where we're supposed to celebrate the Sabbath to remember creation and the glory of creation. This picture here of celebrating Sabbath and remembering creation is God finishing creation and then standing back and resting, but not the resting we're thinking of, not that I've stopped work, I've done it, I'm exhausted, I just can't do it anymore. It is that picture of having you and your husband having created a child. And that child is born. And what have you just gone through as the mother, right? Labor, right? You've labored to have this child come out. But your inkling is not to go, oh, take the child away and just, I'm exhausted, I've got to rest. No. Your rest is glorying in this creation, this amazing miracle. And you and your husband just sit back and just stare. You stop everything to stare and rejoice at this glorious creation. That's what God did with creation. It's to stop work, not because of exhaustion, but because of amazement. Remember, this is the time where God says, and he looked at everything and saw it was very good. Oh, amazing. That's the Sabbath of remembering creation. But he tells Israel a second time that they are commanded forever to celebrate the Sabbath. And one thing we need to understand, Israel, only Israel is commanded to celebrate the Sabbath forever. We're invited to. But this second time when God tells them is actually in Deuteronomy, and he says, celebrate the Sabbath so that you remember me bringing you out of Egypt, so that you remember redemption, that you remember recreation, that you joined me as I am recreating you and giving you new life, that in that redemption of taking you out of Egypt, you get to join me in my presence to establish a new life. So the celebration of Sabbath is entering the delight, recognizing with the surprise of glory in creation that God has created and in recreation that we get to participate in, that we get to be a part of, that we get to make something of the world. What Sabbath really is this space where we flourish in glory. If covenant marriages is about us experiencing that vulnerable cohortative rule, Sabbath is where we get to experience the space of flourishing, that we see the expanded potential and we get to dive into that and we get to see the amazing things that we and God get to create and come together. And it's as if we see some beautiful, beautiful thing in nature. Beauty that we explore and get lost in. It's a day of celebrating, a day of entering into time rather than fighting time, rather than trying to manipulate time and use time. It's that, it's like in the airport where you could get on a moving escalator or a moving sidewalk. And when you do that, you put down your things and you just, wow, this is so cool. And I can converse and I can be in that rhythm here, this flow of time rather than fighting it. Now you're going to get people who fight on the moving sidewalks, right? And what they want to go even faster. Get out of my way, get out of my way. Let me go, 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 so I can get faster. And that's kind of how we use Sabbath, right? We use it as a moving sidewalk. Oh, this is the time I can get more stuff done. Or we just don't know how to enter time. And we think we're supposed to be moving and doing rather than exploring the beauty and glory of what God has given us. It's that question I asked you. What space or place have you entered where it took your breath away? That's what Sabbath is supposed to be. It's supposed to be you entering into time, discovering a place, a space, some reflection of creation or recreation that takes your breath away. And you're able to say, oh, thank you, Lord. Thank you for including me in this moment. And then being able to hear him say, no, thank you for joining me in this glory, for celebrating with me my glory. This is a little bit of what Sabbath looks like. It's not a break. We need to ask ourselves, is what I'm going to do for this Sabbath joy or just a break? Will this lead my heart to wonder or routine? Will I be more grateful or just happy that I got something done? See, when they eschewed Sabbath, when they had markets on Sabbath, they were just routine. It's just what they did every day. Sabbath is supposed to be holy, set apart, so that I might delight in creation and recreation. The Jews call Sabbath the queen. And the word sanctify has the meaning of betrothal. We're betrothed to the queen of our hearts. And we're to prepare our homes for her arrival. We're to welcome Sabbath and anticipate her arrival. Abraham Heschel, a very famous Jewish rabbi, says, to call Sabbath bride is merely to allude to the fact that its spirit is a reality we meet, rather than an empty span of time which we choose to set aside for comfort or recuperation. Sabbath is discovering what's already there. It's entering into eternity, practicing and living in the kingdom where you're just in awe of what God has created. And it protects our minds from thinking that it's all the same, that it's all about transaction. So that's just a little taste of the idea of Sabbath and it being a sanctuary for our mind. I enjoy coloring, but I wouldn't ever spend my time coloring. But on the last two retreats that I spoke at, there were times where you were asked to go color. I'm setting a time. They set a time apart for us. One was in a prayer. Actually, they were both in prayer modes. Just go color. What a delight to say, here's the time. I'm giving you time, which is what I've done here, is I've given you time to listen to music. Just sit back and enter the music. Or enter the coloring and the soothingness of it. You would never take the time to do that. But Sabbath is a gift God gives us to enter in to being delighted with glory, the glory of his creation and the recreation that we get to be a part of. So thirdly, the protection of our strengths is tithing. Tithing actually protects, is a sanctuary for the gifts, abilities and talents that we've been given. In this, we get to experience cohortative tending. I give my strength, so you're able to give your strength, and we uphold each other's glory. So, tithing, instead of thinking of it as an obligation, as a rule, or as a transaction, we are actually invited to enter it as a sanctuary, as a place of protection for our strength. We're invited to enter Sabbath as a sanctuary for our minds and covenant marriages and covenant relationships with people and paradigms as a protection for our hearts. These are places of shalom, places of delightful rest and wholeness. These are places where we glimpse and become familiar with and practice living in a kingdom of grace. And our relationships and our time and our work is reoriented so that we understand this set apart idea. In a covenant marriage, we're set apart for mutual dependence and set apart from independent and competitive tension. We need to understand that so that our set apart doesn't get twisted into going away from the world. Our tithing helps is to bring us to set us apart for the support of others. And it sets us apart from hoarding and gathering in for ourselves and building our own kingdoms. And the Sabbath is set apart for delight in glory growing, delight in both remembering creation and anticipating recreation. And we're set apart from routine. These are gifts, these set apart places. It sets us apart, all of these, all three of these sets us apart for cohortative rule, for being image bearers. And it sets us apart from independent living, trying to find our own identities in the East of Eden. So, When the priests go first, when they purify themselves, living in the kingdom and attentive to their appointed duties, celebrating covenant relationships, celebrating Sabbath, celebrating tithing, then the sacrifices and first fruits, this is the last verse of Nehemiah 13, the sacrifices and first fruits are able to be offered on behalf of all. The kingdom then becomes a vital place, a welcome place where all the nations may come to find healing and holiness, which is what Revelation tells us, right? That place, what it looks like, that vision in Revelation 21, where the temple had, the gates are open all the time, and the temple walls are made of the foundations of the apostles, and there's a river flowing, and on the sides of each river are the trees that bear fruit all the time, the first fruits, and their leaves are for the healing of the nations. Those are us, guys. Those are the priests who volunteered to live in the kingdom today, now. Not in heaven later, but now, today. The kingdom is near, is at hand. The Lord lives here. Father, thank you that you have provided for us sanctuaries for our hearts and our minds and our strengths, that in encouraging us to rebuild the temple where you live within us, to build walls and gates that we might protect the integrity of who you are and what you have to offer. We thank you that in asking us to do those things, you also provide for us protections with the gifts of covenant relationships, and the gift of Sabbath, and the gift of tithing. Father, I pray that we might experience those glimpses of eternity, those glimpses of glory, that we might not see them as obligations and transactions, but that even this week, in some way, you might show us the glory of what it is like to be image bearers of the one and only God. In Jesus' name, amen.